Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
And an FDA advisory committee met today and approved emergency authorization of the Pfizer vaccine. The Congress continues work on a COVID relief funding bill and will continue that into next week. And the Senate is set to vote on a one-week extension of federal funding to keep the government open. That means that the Congress will need to return next week to debate a fiscal year 2021 spending bill as well. Good evening, and thanks for joining us on Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio. I'm Peter Slen. Now, in other news, both Speaker Pelosi and House Republican leader Kevin McCarthy reacted to the allegations that Representative Eric Swalwell, Democrat of California, was targeted by a Chinese spy. The Senate continues to debate defense spending, and former UN ambassador in the Obama administration, Susan Rice, has been selected by President-elect Biden as his chief domestic policy advisor, and former Obama chief of staff, Dennis McDonough, has been picked to lead the Veterans Administration. But we'll start tonight with the FDA and vaccine authorization. The Food and Drug Administration Advisory Committee on Vaccines and Related Biological Products met all day to decide whether the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine should be given emergency authorization for use in the United States. The approval came at about 5:40 p.m. this evening. During the deliberations earlier today, Dr. Duran Fink of the advisory committee explained the approval process.
The use being requested for emergency authorization is for active immunization to prevent COVID-19 caused by SARS-CoV-2 in individuals 16 years of age and older. The information submitted with the request includes safety and efficacy data from a large randomized, blinded, placebo-controlled phase 3 trial. And these data will be discussed in detail in our afternoon sessions. Today, we will be considering whether to make available to millions of Americans an as-yet investigational vaccine that has been developed, tested, and reviewed in record time, with additional testing still underway in ongoing studies. The American public demands and deserves a rigorous, comprehensive, and independent review of the data. And that's what FDA physicians and scientists, all of us career public health servants, have been doing over days, nights, weekends, and yes, over the Thanksgiving holiday. This is in addition to months of review work already completed on information previously submitted in preparation for an EUA request. FDA has been conducting its comprehensive review of the Pfizer-BioNTech COVID-19 vaccine EUA submission since its submission on November 20th. Our review has included verification of clinical data integrity of Pfizer analyses and also our own independent analyses using data sets that were provided in the submission. We have continued an ongoing review of chemistry, manufacturing, and control information, non-clinical data, and review of clinical assays, including information that was submitted shortly prior to the EUA request. We have been reviewing and revising, along with Pfizer, prescribing information and fact sheets for vaccine recipients and healthcare providers. These will be necessary to inform and instruct vaccine recipients and healthcare providers during use of the vaccine under EUA, and these materials are necessarily informed by our review of the data. We have sent and received back answers to multiple information requests addressed to Pfizer to clarify questions related to the data. And last but certainly not least, we have been preparing for today's VRBPAC meeting. Today's meeting, in which the committee will advise FDA with its own independent assessment of the data, continues FDA's commitment to an expedited review process that is transparent, scientifically sound, and data-driven.
And that was Dr. Duran Fink earlier today. He's with the FDA's Vaccine Advisory Committee setting up today's meeting. Now, the FDA's Vaccine Advisory Committee is comprised of independent vaccine experts, infectious disease specialists, industry representatives, and a consumer representative. While the FDA is not required to follow the committee's advice, it is widely expected to do so in this case. Now, here's Dr. Arnold Monto, acting chair of the Vaccine Advisory Committee, setting up the vote.
Okay, I think we are going to vote. So
great. So let's pull up the voting question on the slide, and Dr. Monto, you can read the question for the record.
Based on the totality of scientific evidence available, do the benefits of the Pfizer-BioNTech COVID-19 vaccine outweigh its risks for use in individuals 16 years of age and older? Your vote possibilities are yes or no, and if you want to abstain, you just don't vote. Is that it? Because I thought there was an abstention possibility.
There's an abstain selection. The no vote just shows your name if you haven't made a selection.
Okay. So we have 2 minutes to vote.
Yes. Go ahead and please cast your vote.
And that was an electronic vote, and the final vote was 17-4 in favor of emergency authorization. Now, even as the first coronavirus vaccines are given, follow-up studies on their effectiveness will follow. As Dr. Nancy Messonnier, director of the CDC's National Center for Immunization and Respiratory Diseases, explained at today's meeting.
The most immediate priority is to determine whether the vaccine protects against symptomatic disease as expected based on the phase 3 trial data, but understanding that implementation for these vaccines might be slightly complicated by folks who don't exactly get the second dose exactly on schedule and by the necessity to keep the vaccine in cold chain. So that's going to be the focus, but then there are a variety of subsequent and late stage studies that are being planned or implemented. Number of strategies are used to plan for the assessment of VE, but to facilitate a rapid launch, we've leveraged existing platforms, and for early stage vaccination, we focus on populations likely to be vaccinated first. We're harmonizing and coordinating across the U.S. government on a variety of platforms, for example, using common case definitions, data elements, and methods to improve comparability of results. And we've been working to combine similar platforms to improve geographic representation, increase statistical power, and generate more timely and robust VE estimates. And we do have a diversity of methods as we understand that all observation methods have limitations. Here's a summary of the studies that are being planned. And again, I don't have time to go through all of them, but I would just put you to the top row. You know, for the most immediate question of whether vaccines work as expected, we're planning a prospective study among healthcare workers. There is no large existing database enriched for this group, and so we're doing a test negative design case control study among healthcare workers, which should help us relatively quickly assess this outcome. So, in summary, planned VE studies will provide a robust assessment of COVID-19 vaccine performance in real-world settings. We believe we will have early VE estimates in groups prioritized for vaccination, VE against key outcomes, and in important subgroups. And data from these studies will address critical gaps and help guide future use of vaccine. Systems are in place to monitor the safety of COVID-19 vaccination in healthcare workers and long-term care facility residents. BeSafe, VAERS, and HSN will detect adverse event signals for further follow-up and evaluation. CMS, Genesis, and other claims-based and EHR systems will be used for both signal detection and evaluation. Vaccine effectiveness in healthcare workers is the immediate priority and will address the question of does the vaccine work as expected. We expect those studies to start immediately. And vaccine effectiveness evaluations in older adults, including those in long-term care facilities, are planned and include both test negative design and cohort evaluations. I hope that does justice to all the systems that we're planning and that are in place. Understand that vaccine safety and effective monitoring is a top priority for the U.S. government, and we're committed to ensuring that all these systems are in place and ready to go as soon as the vaccine program is implemented. Thank you.
And that was Dr. Nancy Messonnier, Director of the National Center for Immunization and Respiratory Diseases at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. That was from today's all-day FDA Vaccine Advisory Committee meeting. Now, the FDA is expected soon to consider another coronavirus vaccine developed by Moderna and the National Institutes of Health. And a third by AstraZeneca and Oxford University is also making its way through the process. Now, just a reminder that today's all-day Food and Drug Administration Vaccine Advisory Committee hearing is available to listen to and watch online at cspan.org. Well, turning to the coronavirus economic aid package negotiations on Capitol Hill, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi says she believes the bipartisan group of lawmakers working on a compromise is nearing a deal. Here she is speaking with reporters.
Madam Speaker, you've thrown your lot in with this bipartisan group that's talking about the stimulus package. They are having a hard time coming to a final product. How long do they have to produce a product? And if they can't do that, do you then have to look at what Leader McConnell has suggested, which is allow some of these other things to fall away and do a smaller package?
Well, let's go. This is a smaller package. And as I have said, this is not a stimulus package. It's an emergency supplemental to deal with what we have. I think they've made great progress. I think they have some certain things remain, and that's up to them. I don't know the inner workings. But I think they've made great progress, and I salute them for that. Of course, as always, we have to see the text, but I think the values that and the priorities that they have established are what we need to do right away. So I don't share your view. Again, who knows? We'll see how it goes. But we do have to, we cannot leave here without having a piece of legislation. And I can say this unequivocally. What Mr. McConnell is putting forth in terms of liability is such an assault on Americans' workers that I hope that the group goes nowhere near what he is presenting.
At what point do you have to start negotiating directly with Leader McConnell?
The normal course of events is the committees do their negotiation. And again, I'm an appropriator. As you've heard me say again and again, left to their own devices, the appropriators can come to the solution. So, I've spoken with the chairman of the committee in the Senate, Senator Shelby. I think he's committed to keeping government open and having a bipartisan bill. Nita Lowey on our side. Those are the two main negotiators in all of this. Also, again, they want to find common ground, and I think they're close to that. And then when the committees cannot find their common ground, what is left is what is kicked up to the principals in terms of leadership. We don't negotiate the bill all along. So when that comes, if they have not resolved, which I hope they will and they can, then that's when we would, the normal regular order would be.
And that was House Speaker Nancy Pelosi earlier today. And at a separate news conference, House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy said he supports a larger aid bill.
No, I actually support the plan that's actually more money, that is supported by the president, supported by the Republican leaders, that would actually go to more people, help more people in a time of need, would put more than $300 billion for small business, would allow us to use money that's already appropriated, so be fiscally responsible at the same time, and to do that now. The only person who's holding it up is the same person that's held it up for the last 4 months, Speaker Pelosi. Yes. Yes, it easily could get done.
And that was House Republican Leader Kevin McCarthy outside the U.S. Capitol today. Now, Politico reports that Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell's staff told other congressional leaders this week that the effort by the bipartisan coronavirus negotiators to link $160 billion in state and local aid with the temporary coronavirus liability shield will be unlikely to satisfy Senate Republicans. Senator McConnell spoke about that on the Senate floor.
We learned a few minutes ago that new unemployment claims just hit their highest weekly total since mid-September. It's the largest one-week jump since back in March, and the number of continuing claims, people struggling with joblessness on an ongoing basis, which had plateaued for months, but at least not increased, just ticked back up as well. Our economic recovery thus far has been faster than expected. Americans are tough and resilient, but our people need another dose of support as we hope to close out our battle with this virus. We should be doing everything we can to prevent layoffs, create jobs where possible, and race toward the vaccines that will end this nightmare. While Democrats hold the Paycheck Protection Program hostage over controversial state government bailouts, family businesses are closing their doors. While Democrats resist the kinds of common sense legal protections that we put in place during past emergencies, our reopening and recovery is threatened by, according to one estimate, now listen to this, so far 6,500 lawsuits have been filed and counting. 6,500 lawsuits filed and counting. Here's what one litigator told one reporter a couple of days ago. These lawsuits are, quote, pretty common these days. I've seen 10 like this over the last 30 days. The American Council on Education told Congress in May, that colleges and universities need temporary but strong legal protections. Now, our Democratic colleagues want to pretend they're bravely fighting big corporations, but they're really bullying small business owners and college presidents who've been pleading for these protections for months. Our Democratic colleagues have not even let us pass non-controversial money to invest in vaccine distribution. Not unless the two parties settle a whole list of issues that are controversial the way that they want to settle them. So I hope our colleagues let Congress deliver more help soon. A lot of Americans simply cannot afford to wait.
That was Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell on the Senate floor today. In other coronavirus relief news, Republican Senator Josh Hawley introduced legislation today to provide a second round of stimulus checks of $1,200 to most Americans, an effort supported by independent Senator Bernie Sanders. And Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin has pitched $600 checks. Stimulus checks are currently not in the proposals from either Senate Republicans or the bipartisan group of lawmakers. Senate Democratic leader Chuck Schumer also spoke on the floor today about the state of the negotiations.
It's impossible to imagine any community in this country functioning without them. And this morning, we learned that an additional 1.4 million Americans filed new unemployment claims, a huge spike from the previous week. If you want to save jobs, if you want to make sure those numbers don't go up, we need PPP for small business, and we need state and local aid for our governments, because both aid those entities and prevent people from being laid off and unemployment from going up. The liability provisions of the leader have nothing to do with that, and in fact only affect a very small number of lawsuits. So, if we're going to be here on the floor and talking about saving jobs, we have to talk about saving the essential jobs of essential public employees. They deserve our help, too. They're no different than anyone else, whether they're in a red state or a blue state. And make no mistake, right now, there's one person, just one person, standing in the way, and that is Leader McConnell. Now on another matter. Despite the fact that the presidential election ended well over a month ago, and that by now every single state in the country and the District of Columbia have certified results, there are still many on the political right who refuse to accept reality. Today, amazingly enough, 17 Republican attorneys general will meet with President Trump to discuss their desperate and wildly irresponsible lawsuit, which aims to literally overturn the will of the people on the grounds they didn't like the results. This has gone beyond ridiculous. No court in this country has found any of President Trump's claims of widespread voter fraud credible. No serious state election official, Democrat and Republican, has found them credible. Even the Trump administration's Justice Department so browbeaten into political activities over the past 4 years has not found a scrap of evidence that would affect the final result. And yet, rather than accept the simple truth that Joe Biden will be the next president of the United States, there are actually sitting senators and Congress members who prefer to undermine our democracy by indulging President Trump's wild conspiracy theories about a stolen election.
And that was Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer on the Senate floor today. And again, as a reminder, there's a one-week continuing resolution. There's a federal budget for FY 2021. There's defense spending, and there's coronavirus relief aid, all to be decided. The House is adjourned for the week, and most of that will be done next week. And also being reported today in Washington is the potential email deletion ordered by Robert Redfield of the Centers for Disease Control. Lenny Bernstein is with the Washington Post. Mr. Bernstein, what is this story about?
This story, if people remember, takes us back to the summer when there was a lot of controversy over possible attempts by Trump administration political appointees to interfere with the guidance and advice and science coming out of the CDC regarding the coronavirus and its transmission. The main issue today is whether the director of the CDC ordered one of those emails that attempted to manipulate the guidance deleted. And that is being asserted by the Oversight Committee in Congress that is watching the government's response.
And this involves an HHS employee named Charlotte Kent, is that correct?
The Charlotte Kent is the CDC employee who is the editor-in-chief of the most authoritative, sacrosanct CDC report of the many that they produce. It's called the Morbidity and Mortality Weekly Report. It's the holy of holies over there at the CDC. It's where they put out information and guidance for the public. She was the editor of that document and asserted in an interview with this House subcommittee on Monday that she was ordered to delete an email from someone at HHS who was trying to interfere.
And that would have been Paul Alexander.
That would be Paul Alexander, the advisor to Health and Human Services Secretary Alex Azar.
Do we know what the email said?
Yeah, it does. There's no question on what the email said. It was leaked during the summer, and it was produced today in this report. And basically what it said was, I'm going to paraphrase here, these CDC scientists are putting out information that they hope will harm the president and his efforts to reopen the country. And I want this to come to a halt, and I want to see these emails. I'm sorry, I want to see these reports before they go out. I want to vet them.
Now, according to a statement by Robert Redfield, head of the CDC, he said that he instructed CDC staff to ignore Dr. Paul Alexander's email.
Correct. That is what he says, and he may very well have done that. The MMWR was not altered, in fact, and it was not retracted. But the issue here today is whether he tried to cover up Alexander's efforts by ordering the email destroyed or deleted.
And that's what's being asserted, correct?
That's what's being asserted by Jim Clyburn, the head of this subcommittee. And the way Clyburn says he knows this is that their investigators interviewed Dr. Kent on Monday. She said that she was told that Redfield gave this order. It came down through the chain of command, and that she was supposed to delete this email. Now, she was on vacation at the time, so this was told to her by the person filling in for her. And when she went back to look for the email to delete it, as she said she was ordered to do, the email was already gone.
So what could be the significance of this story, Lenny Bernstein?
The significance of this story could be if Clyburn is accurate, that the CDC director, the leader of our entire public health response on the coronavirus, was helping to cover up efforts by a Trump administration official to skew that guidance. Again, I want to emphasize that that guidance was not changed and it was not withdrawn. But even the effort of political appointees to manipulate that information is highly unusual, highly suspect. And if the CDC director took part after the fact in trying to cover that up by getting rid of an email, that would be a very serious issue and even carry some potential criminal penalties.
Now, Robert Redfield is leaving the CDC at the end of the Trump administration?
The incoming Biden administration has named a new CDC director, Rochelle Walensky. So, yes, when Biden takes over, Walensky takes over, and Redfield will no longer be in charge of the CDC.
Lenny Bernstein, thank you for the update on this story.
Absolutely. My pleasure.
This episode is brought to you by ShipStation. If you run an e-commerce business, you know how much work it takes to produce something great while dealing with complicated shipping issues. That's why over 130,000 companies have turned to ShipStation, an innovative tool that allows you to focus less on shipping and more on building your brand. With ShipStation, you can manage orders, label printing, reporting, and customer service on one easy-to-use dashboard. You'll reduce warehouse costs with reliable enterprise solutions and save thousands on shipping costs with discounts up to 89% off. Plus, you can effortlessly import orders from everywhere you sell online. So, turn your shipping challenges into opportunities for growth. Go to ShipStation.com and use code POD to sign up for your free 60-day trial. That's ShipStation.com, code POD.
And welcome back to Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio. I'm Peter Slynn. A few more headlines. Israel and Morocco agreed to normalize relations in a deal brokered by the U.S. Morocco is the fourth Arab country to do so recently, joining the UAE, Bahrain, and Sudan. President Trump tweeted that it was a massive breakthrough for peace in the Middle East. Several senior FBI officials have been accused of sexual harassment but avoided disciplinary action in recent years, according to an investigation by the Associated Press. And Doug Emhoff, the husband of Vice President-elect Kamala Harris, will be teaching at the Georgetown University's Law School in Washington, D.C. next semester. Well, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi is voicing support for fellow Democratic Congressman Eric Swalwell after a report linked Swalwell with a suspected Chinese spy. Here's Speaker Pelosi.
You've long been concerned about China. You have a history
here, yes,
steeped on the Intelligence Committee here. Are we to a point now, after what happened with Mr. Swalwell, maybe where there should be background checks for all staff and interns before the service? Obviously, members, staff who serve on the Intelligence Committee and Armed Services Committee have that, but should that be universal, and what are your concerns?
So what should be universal, Chad, on this?
Background checks for aides or interns across the board for all members, all staff and interns on Capitol Hill after the concerns about Mr. Swalwell.
Well, I don't have any concern about Mr. Swalwell. There are those in the Congress who believe, and I am among them, that we should be seeing what influence the Chinese. I've been fighting them, as you know, for over 30 years in terms of their undue influence at universities in our country and the overtures they try to make to members of Congress. In terms of Mr. Swalwell, in the spring of 2015, the leadership of the House and the committee were informed that overtures from a Chinese person were being made to members of Congress. When that was made known to the members of Congress, it was over. You know, that was the end of any communication with those people. So it isn't, I think we should make sure that everybody knows what they are being subjected to But I don't know that it means that we have to black background checks for every intern who comes into the Capitol. I do think that it's unfortunate that Mr. McCarthy is trying to make an issue of this when his leader—we all found out at the same time, the Republican leadership and that several members had been approached.
Were you briefed on this?
We were all at the same moment, the House, Republican and Democratic leaders, and the leadership of the committee were briefed at the same moment. Make sure you know that, because he keeps going around saying, when did they know? We knew when they knew.
And as you heard, Speaker Pelosi referenced House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy, who also spoke about the matter.
Speaker Pelosi was notified. I was not. I'm asking for an FBI briefing now. But if she knew and maintained Swalwell on intel, wrong. He is a national security threat. He was put on in his second year. I will tell you, as a leader, Intel Committee is treated differently. Why? Because those who serve on Intel get information that members do not. For the Republican side, the leader, Republican leader appoints there. For the Democrat side, the Democrats appoint there. And to spend the last 4 years in Intel worried about foreign intrusion, Adam Schiff knew as well. To allow Eric Swalwell to sit inside a skiff where you do not bring your phones, you do not bring your watch, because what is to discuss? He puts the threat of everybody else of what they're talking about as well. Why did she allow him to stay on that committee? And let's hope she does not in the next Congress either. The Democrat leader appoints the Democrat side. The question raises, when did she know? Why did she keep him? The same question that Adam Schiff. Did anybody approach Nancy Pelosi to lobby to put a person on their second term in the minority on Intel Committee? That's a question I have to know. Then the next question will arise, why did the Democrats pull out of a bipartisan task force on China after they agreed they would? This just raises so many more questions. Eric Swalwell should take it upon himself to resign from Intel. Why did Eric Swalwell, knowing what he knew after he was warned by the FBI, he didn't go to them, they went to him. Why did he challenge the director of Intel, John Radcliffe, when he just briefed the American public on the rise of China's spying? Why did he challenge that and take China's side and not America? That begins to raise a question, too, and I would hope the Democrat leadership would raise a question for them. It's an easy one to answer for me. He is a national risk that should not serve on the Intel Committee. Swalwell was swindled, and he should be against China now instead of keep standing up for them.
And that was House Republican Leader Kevin McCarthy on Capitol Hill today. Now, the Axios publication first reported that a woman named Christine Fang, or Fang Fang, who had helped fundraise for Congressman Swalwell in the past and placed at least one intern in his office, was a suspected Chinese spy. Congressman Swalwell said this week that his criticism of President Trump and his work to impeach the president may have led to the timing of this story. In other news, the Senate is continuing work today on the Annual Defense Policy and Programs Bill, or NDAA, which stands for National Defense Authorization Act. President Trump has threatened to veto the current version, but Republican Senator James Inhofe, who is chair of the Armed Services Committee, believes the Senate will defy that veto threat.
We will pass this bill. It's one that, if we don't pass it, we're not going to give the resources necessary for our kids in the field to have the safety that we can provide them, and to have the equipment. We want to get to the point where we have the very best of everything out there. And right now we don't. China and Russia are knocking at our door. We have to do a better job than we've done in the past, and I'm going to be working with the administration to do everything we can for in the coming year. But right now, we need to get caught up and go ahead and pass this bill. This bill is the roadmap for the next year, and that's why this is important. So I encourage all of us to do what we have to do to get this bill done, hopefully today, but definitely by tomorrow. I believe that will happen because people do care about our troops.
And that was Armed Services Committee Chair James Inhofe on the Senate floor today. President Trump's veto threat is because it contains a provision that would require the renaming of military bases named for Confederate leaders, and because it does not have a provision he wants, a repeal of Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act, which gives online platforms like Facebook and Twitter liability protection for postings from third parties. Now back to the Senate floor, Republican Rand Paul opposes the $720 billion defense bill.
Until recently, this chorus of voices sang of nothing but the almighty endless powers that presidents have as commander-in-chief. That is, until a president arrived on the scene who wanted to reduce overseas troop levels and end America's longest war in Afghanistan. Then the promoters of a strong commander-in-chief suddenly jumped ship and began advocating the opposite. They began advocating that 535 members of Congress should indeed become generals and should limit the president's ability to remove troops from Afghanistan. Which is it? Are you for this unlimited power of the president to commence and execute war, or are you only for it when they're initiating war, when there are continuing war and against presidential prerogative if the president chooses to end a war? Shouldn't we call out this hypocrisy? Shouldn't someone stand up and express and expose this rank demagoguery? Shouldn't someone cry foul that the advocates of unlimited presidential power want it only to apply when that president advocates for war? But the moment a president advocates to end a war or lessen overseas troops and these deployments, he or she must be shackled by 535 generals. This defense authorization bill could more aptly be called a bill to prevent the president from ending the Afghan war. We never actually give the real titles to the bill, but that would be an accurate title. A bill to prevent the president from ending the Afghan war. As such, any serious advocate for ending the Afghan war should vote against this monstrosity. The neocon advocates for unlimited presidential war powers should own up to their hypocrisy and admit that their love of perpetual war trumps their off-stated unitary executive theory. In reality, the neocons are enamored of their theory of unbounded presidential power only when that power is used to foment war. The minute a president decides to end war, the neocons' true stripes are exposed as they beat their chests and proclaim, as 535 generals might, that the president will not be allowed to remove troops without congressional permission. This bill sets a very dangerous precedent for limiting a president's power to end war and should be vigorously opposed.
And that was Senator Rand Paul of Kentucky on the Senate floor today. Now, the House this week has already passed the defense bill, and it passed it by a vote that could override the threatened presidential veto. Well, the outcome of one of the last uncalled races in the House of Representatives may be decided by the House. Find out about Iowa's 2nd Congressional District race on C-SPAN's The Weekly Podcast this week with Zachary Oren of the Iowa Press Citizen. Here's a preview.
So tell us about these two women as candidates.
So both Rita Hart comes from a background as a sort of a long-term educator. Marionette Miller Meeks has a long career as an ophthalmologist, both long careers here in Southeast Iowa. The two of them also have state legislative experience representing different districts here. They both have had connections to larger campaigns. Rita Hart was a lieutenant governor candidate in a sort of unsuccessful attempt by Fred Hubble to take the governorship in 2018. And Marionette Miller Meeks has this is actually her fourth run for this seat as the retiring Democrat Dave Loebsack, who is leaving the seat open. She ran against him three times before this, in 2008, 2010, and then again, and I believe it was 2014. all of which came with the, smaller margins of that loss, right? So she, each year she's sort of gotten her name out there, getting a little bit closer until November 3rd, when she was ahead by just 282 votes. And I remember writing with such great surprise that 282 votes would separate these two women from taking the seat for the second district. Well, it has since shrunk to, over the recount, has shrunk to just 6 votes, which is nothing short of extraordinary.
And that was a preview with Zachary Oren Smith, who's a reporter for the Iowa Press Citizen. That's the latest episode of the weekly podcast, and you can find it wherever you listen to your podcasts. Well, the National Menorah lighting took place today outside the White House, celebrating the first night of Hanukkah. Due to COVID-19, there were fewer people there than in past years, and face masks were required. Rabbi Levi Shemtov is vice president of American Friends of Lubavitch, which sponsors the annual event. He says there is a lesson in our needing to and ability to adapt.
On a normal year, there are somewhat 15,000 such celebrations that are brought to communities by over 5,000 of my colleagues in all 50 states and over 100 countries. This year, not everyone has the access to an open field like this to have their menorah lighting. Many people have to celebrate at home. Even the press pool is so much smaller because the riser can only hold a certain amount of people, and all the networks got together to have one camera delivering to all of them. I think that in there is a lesson. I'm a follower of the Lubavitcher Rebbe, Rabbi Menachem Schneerson of sacred memory, a foremost leader of the Jewish people in our generation, who was actually awarded the Congressional Gold Medal in 1994. He taught us that when a challenge comes before you, you do not respond with fear or weakness. You look for and discover a strength that maybe you yourself did not even know you had. And you figure out how to make it work in the best way possible. I think that this is our answer to our situation. We can't have the thousands of people who normally come here, so we put extra resources and effort into making sure that as many people as possible could watch this. And I know for a fact that there are thousands of locations where families have gotten onto Zoom meetings where they are featuring this link. We may be socially distanced in this time, but we must be sure to be emotionally and spiritually close and united, even more than ever before.
And that was Rabbi Levi Shemtov at the National Hanukkah Menorah Lighting outside the White House. President Jimmy Carter was the first president to attend this event in 1979, and President George H.W. Bush was the first to display a menorah inside the White House in 1989. Well, thanks for joining us today. Download the free C-SPAN radio app to listen to C-SPAN Radio and C-SPAN anywhere. And get your podcast, including that of Washington Today, wherever you find them. Have a good evening.